Hello, everyone, and welcome back. Another episode of Under the Radar SFF Books Podcast. I'm your host, Blaze, as always. Thank you so much for joining me and listening wherever you may be around the world. And today is a very special author interview. We're doing a deep dive on one of my favorite epic fantasy series, The Traitor Sun Cycle, with author Christian Cameron, also known as Miles Cameron. And so glad to be joined by him. Christian, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Blaze, and thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I always enjoy talking about Red Knight.
Oh, wonderful. I remember when Red Knight first came out, as you said, it was in 2011. That was right when I was getting, I just graduated college. I was getting right on the cusp of entering epic fantasy. There was Game of Thrones was very popular, and I was looking for what was next. And yours just jumped to the page, one with the beautiful covers, the two of them, the English one and the U.S. edition one. And just the attention to detail on like the battle formations and the love for characters is just fantastic. Now, I know we're asking you to go back a little bit, but could you dive into what was the inspiration for the Red Knight and kind of what you wanted to accomplish with this series?
Well, there's a bunch of different inspirations, and I think like every author, I'd be hard put to touch on all of them, but I can tell you two or three really big inspirations. One was my wonderful editor, and I think everybody has to say that, but I mean it, Gillian Redfern, who basically popped into, so I write historical novels, I think you know that, and up until then I'd written spy novels or thrillers, and I'd written historical novels, and Gillian Redfern popped into my editor's office at Orion and said, you know, your historicals editor said you'd always wanted to write a fantasy novel. I'm like, yep, that is totally true. And I said, it's really funny because I don't really read historical novels. I mean, I do sometimes, but I read fantasy. That's what I read, fantasy and science fiction. And she's like, great, you know, pitch me something. And I said, you know, like I'm caught by surprise. I don't really have something to say. And she said, well, I've always had this idea that we get like the Arthurian stories completely wrong and they should be told from the point of view of a dragon. Like what would it be like on the other side? So that was definitely an influence, I won't lie, because I sort of in my mind invented the WYLD, the wild, as like a side that had a life of its own and wasn't necessarily bad. It was just different. And I sort of invented that during my conversation with Gillian, and Gillian deserves more than a bow or a nod because she definitely had that input. And then the other thing that is incredibly nerdy is that a lot of the nation states, some elements of the map, some of the politics, and even a couple of the characters are from my University Dungeons and Dragons campaign. And let me add to that, that my University Dungeons and Dragons campaign encompassed 28 to 30 people, large scale miniatures, combat, role-playing games, the drama club, and like it ate us for a while. It became sort of the center of activity. So a lot of the really sort of murky, fun politics that lie behind a lot of it, I owe to the creation of my friends who had really great skullduggery ideas of how to do each other badly in nation state politics. And then finally, the last influence, I do a lot of research and I read this really great book. It's quite old, and it's about the European fur. And, you know, we North Americans, we know all about the fur trade. The fur trade is how white colonialists came here and got First Nations people to do the trapping and bring in the furs. What I'd never really understood is that that was a direct continuation of an enormous medieval European fur trade that extended as far east as the Ural Mountains and basically extincted forms of squirrel, beaver, and every other fur-bearing animal in most of Northern Europe, and that fortunes rose and fell across Europe with the availability of fur, which, if you want to make this a deep dive, I really worked into the book, because some of the book or some of the series is really just not about war, it's about financing the war. Oh, I also read a great book about counterfeiting in the Middle Ages, which also appears almost really dull to people who haven't read the books, but I'm unapologetic. I think it's useful, even in a fantasy world, to show what lies beneath, you know, not just the past, something that most fantasy writers approach and agreed, you know, like Tolkien did an incredible job of giving his world thousands of years have passed. But like, how does it work? Where does the wheat come from? Who feeds the knights? What do the monsters eat? A question I always used to ask about dungeon playing. Like, what? How do they live down there? Anyway, here we all are.
Yeah, here we all are. And you're right. You fit all of that into the series. It's obviously, I believe the first, even just the first half of The Red Knight is not about this big battle. It's the mustering of the troops. It's people moving into the right places, how the people are going to be saved, how the crops and all the other stuff. It's amazing what you encompass. Now, the setting for the series takes place in Alba. And it's, if you look at the map and look at some of the regions, it almost looks like a redoing of medieval Europe. I'm assuming you had that in mind when you were constructing this book, and you took the influences from all the books that you were saying before. Is that right?
Well, actually, Blaise, if you look at Alba and all those places, it's really a redrawing of North America. If you look at the positioning of things, Alba is the kingdom of Alba is pretty much in the place of New York State. New England is replaced with the empire, and north of quote unquote the wall is sort of Canada. And in fact, the central action of the books takes place in the Adna Crags, which is a thin cover for the Adirondack Mountains, one of my favorite places in upstate New York. And Ticonderoga, the fortress over which they fight for three books, is loosely based on the fortress of Ticonderoga. So I have to differ with you. While the map of Europe is used to create Gaul, which is sort of an analog of Imperial Germany and France in the 14th century, it's out off across an ocean. And, you know, it's not just Europe and North America, because I chose to put a lot of things I love all together. So Northern Alba is very like the Adirondacks, but it is also very like Cumbria in England. I love the Lake District, and the Lake District looks a little like the Adirondacks, so I literally ran them together. I thought that was perfectly okay. And I stole my favorite locations from both. And then, because I love Greece, I stuck the Byzantine Empire on the edge of it. But even with that, I'm not going to say I dislike the term historical fantasy, but I am going to say I believe that every piece of fantasy ever written is to some extent influenced by history, because history is the story of all the human beings, and we don't really have any other stories to tell. So whether it's how swords are shaped or what boots look like or whatever, we're borrowing that from somewhere. Once in a while, you read a fantasy novel where it's all just completely made up, and that can be very interesting, or it can be very hard to read. But mine is inspired by history, but that's not Europe. That's not North America. And the gradual encroachment of an entire world of semi-undead certainly changes the political nature of everything.
Yeah, I'd say so. And I stand corrected. I got confused with some of the names with the characters as some of the influences, but we'll get to that in due time. So the main plot and the main characters of our story, it's the Red Knight and his group of mercenaries. They are commissioned for a job by the Abbess of Lysencirc, there's basically a murder, and they're brought in to investigate and basically stop whatever outside forces are trying to attack the Abbess. It's a deep dive, so we can say this is a semi-spoiler, but the main character, the Red Knight, his name's Gabriel. I just fell in love with him. And even though he's so young, he's only 19 years old at the start of the story, he has so much intelligence in terms of moving pieces around. He's very brave. He knows what needs to be done. And he gives off a lot of courage, and he gives off a lot of stoic. He's very solid. He's like a rock. And then you have all these other sets of characters around him. You have Bad Tom, this brute of a man, but also with a kind of a kind heart. And he's also hilarious. And Sauce, who she has a dark past, but she's always someone you want by your side to root for. I know going a little back, but can you just go through like the construction of these characters and the mercenary group for the Red Knight? Because obviously they're the crux of the story.
Sure. So one of the original ideas, which does play through and actually hasn't been much talked about in media, which is kind of funny to me, is that really this is the world of King Arthur. So I never named the king ever in five books, but to some extent, he's Arthur. And that makes Gabriel Mordred, because Mordred is the child of rape. Arthur has raped his sister and given birth to this child. I mean, this is one of the many different Arthurian mythos, but it's a terrible story. Like, and so I wanted to play with that story and go like, what if Mordred was the good guy? Or given how we, and in the myth, how Arthur behaves, how could he possibly be the good guy? Our modern society does not accept that boys will be boys or good people do really bad things. We're more inclined to believe that bad people do really bad things. And if good people do bad things, maybe they're not as good as they seem. And that I wanted to get to from the beginning. So even though he's never described as a major character, the king, who never gets a name, is he sort of rolls along through the novels for a while, not being particularly competent and not being particularly trustworthy. And his problem is just weakness. He just keeps making the easy way, the easy decision. Anyway, and Gabriel, on the other hand, while having real problems with his own mother, which, I mean, I played for all it was worth because I had real problems with my mother and I knew that was good drama. Gabriel can't stand the king and can't abide him and doesn't even want to tell people that he's the king's bastard son. He doesn't want to play that card ever because he takes no joy in it. So a big part of the making of Gabriel was his parentage. Like, and I wanted him to be someone who had to be very tough young. And I give him a bunch of background to explain, because let's face it, 19-year-olds are not usually commanding mercenary companies and getting it right. And I also make clear that because, you know, he is ostensibly the child of a very powerful duke and actually the bastard of the king, that he can get away with murder. So yeah, as a 19-year-old, you know, like he's a rich kid and his parents have bought him a mercenary company. And eventually I'll write some short stories, by the way, to explain this, because I have it all plotted out in the prequel. And I would love to sort of do a prequel, like how does the company come together? Sort of the making of. I'll be honest, most of the other people, even down to some very small roles, are at least loosely based on real people I know, either people I knew in the military, people I've met in everyday life, people I've met in my reenactment life. And I mean, they're not fully based. Fiction is fiction. I'm a pretty decent character writer and I do not really steal people whole. But on the other hand, the ability of two of my friends to have a spat over nothing was always hilarious to the rest of us sitting around and made for great dialogue between Sauce and Bad Tom, who, let's face it, really enjoy the engagements of having a spat. And most of us have friends like this, friends that we know we can count on when a little drunk to go after each other. So yeah, that made for good dialogue. And also there were a lot of tropes I wanted to play with. I was very interested in having a major female character who was a knight. And I know a fair amount about medieval knighthood and I wanted to approach it realistically. So as an historian, I'm pretty sure that some women in 14th century Italy made their way up through the ranks of some of the mercenary companies. There's reasons to believe this. And most of them would probably have started as various forms of camp followers, laundresses, sex workers, whatever. But because they were trusted members of the company and that was more important than social status, they gradually fought their way up into being basically knights. And I thought that that was a believable approach to having a very important woman soldier, as opposed to, I don't know, like there are many ways of going about it, but I wanted my fantasy to be gritty and sort of deal with the hard truths of the Middle Ages. Complete side point, I originally wrote like not even a chapter, almost a novella for each novel, which was just about peasants living in Occitan, and all of the events of the novels are far away. And they don't care because their whole lives are just raising their crops and paying their taxes. And like dragons and knights come and go and they don't care at all. And I just wanted to get across that maybe this is how the great and the noble are living and they're dealing with these world events. But down at the grassroots level, it's getting the wheat crop in on time and worrying about whether a storm takes out the corn. And, you know, and I kind of wanted to get that element of the Middle Ages across too. It just that it didn't make for great fantasy reading. I guess it was a little too realistic. Anyway, that ended up on the cutting room floor. But Sauce was a little bit of that, because the life of women in the real Middle Ages wasn't that great. And I wanted to get across some of that without making it too hard to read.
Awesome. And one we didn't get a chance to talk about is Michael Gabriel's page is the right word, or
Squire.
His squire. His story throughout the series is one that I enjoyed immensely, especially his progression and where he ends up going. Was there someone you based Michael off on? Was he one a friend or like during a campaign?
Michael is based on a few people. Michael is to me almost a kind of young man, and maybe Michael is a little bit me. Like I was the college boy in every war movie, you know, like the stupid college boy who doesn't know how anything works and whatever. And I mean, I was in the United States Navy, and I learned a great deal from the Navy. And one of the things I learned is that actually everyone matters, not just people with university educations. And that was, I should have known that. My dad already believed that, but I'd somehow scraped through it without coming to believe it. And then it was sort of kicked into me in the military. And I wanted to follow that little character arc with Michael, because Michael has a lot of learning to do. And of course, Michael ends up married to a laundress. Instead of a duchess, and that is all part of Michael's arc of figuring out what he needs to know about how the world works.
Awesome. So we talked about the mercenary company and all the good characters.
Oh, now let's talk a little... I didn't get to the mercenary company. Sorry. So, like, I also write historical novels about medieval mercenary companies, and one of the things, I'm going to go all the way back to your first question, inspiration. And we were just sitting around drinking and trying to decide, like, could you use a medieval mercenary company, which for its day was the most technologically advanced military formation? How would it do against a dragon, a wyvern, a horde of orcs? Like, and we just sat around, not gaming it, but going like, what would you hurt a wyvern with? Like, what? How would you change the lance organization? This is a real organization from the time. Like, what would armor work? And we're like, yeah, armor would suddenly be even more important. Anyway, so the mercenary company as described, the way they use horses, the times they dismount, all of that, that is all based very exactly on historical models. Because part of the fun for me, because I have other novels about medieval mercenary companies in Italy in the 14th century, was going like, yep, it's an English mercenary company fighting monsters. What fun is that? I just had to slip that in.
No, please. I love all the information as much as we can get about this great series. So as we just talked about the great mercenary company, now we'll talk about the opposition, not necessarily the quote unquote antagonist, which is the Wild. It's made up of not just Urks and Boglins and Warrens and Dragons, but it's also made up of humans as well, tribes who live in the wilds. But we were meant to believe, like, from the beginning that they're the big enemy. But as you find out in the series, it's the people who have, like, encroached on the wilds and take away their land. So they have something that they're fighting for. And they're being, quote unquote, led by this great mythical, magical force known as Thorn, who is, let me tell you, one of the more interesting characters I've ever read in fantasy. Could you just talk to me a little bit about the inspiration for Thorn and maybe some of the wild creatures in general?
So I'm going to start by saying, as much as I love the Middle Ages, I love the wilderness. And the wilderness that I know best is the Canadian wilderness and the upstate New York world of the Adirondack Mountains. And the Adirondack Mountains, 6.5 million acres of, I mean, there's people there, but it's very wild, and there's moose and bear and all kinds of stuff. And you don't have to be out in the woods very long, unless you are made of rock, to realize that even if there aren't wyverns, that there's a whole world out here and it doesn't really care very much about you. It's not against you. It's just doesn't really care much about you. And that's kind of fun. And I was sitting in a campfire after I decided to write this. And, you know, I had already thought of the juxtaposition of the wild and the world of man. But I hadn't really decided what I was going to do with it. And that particular evening, we're back to inspirations. I didn't see the bear, but I heard the bear and I saw the bear's tracks, probably her tracks the next morning. And I thought, like, bears. Bears are great because they're big. People are scared of them. And they really don't care anything about human life. About our lives, unless we provide like apples and honey. Like they're off doing their bear things and they have very little to do with us. And I thought, that's how I want the wild to be. I want the wild to be doing its own thing. And then I will fully admit that there is a tiny bit of neocolonialist allegory there, you know, like the people moving into the continent and displacing the people and things that live there that I enjoy. I'm a modern lefty, and I kind of wanted to just take a vague swat at European colonialism. Even while some of my European colonial types were some of the protagonists, it was still fun to remind people that at some level, Thorne is sort of magical Tecumseh rallying his various peoples against encroachment, as you say. And the encroachment is somewhat inexplicable, and I put several speeches in Gabriel's mouth basically saying to the abbess and other leaders, like, we wouldn't be here if you hadn't done X. You know, if you hadn't cut all the trees down in these fields, I don't think we'd be here. And it's worth mentioning that Gabriel's mother, the king's sister, is basically a witch of the wild. So she has raised him to be a prince of the wild. He is not just sort of the European colonizer. He lives in both worlds. And that's one of the things that makes him interesting, I hope, to the reader. But, you know, the other thing about the wild is that I wanted the wild to not be one thing. This isn't Sauron with every orc obeying him. This is more like Saruman with 80 factions he has to keep, you know, pulling together. And I love like First Nations life ways, and I wanted to work some of that in. And you know, one of the things, if you're a student of, say, the American Revolution or the Seven Years' War or any of the colonial wars, First Nations people tended to fight for their own reasons. Huge surprise. And so they would sort of come and go from European campaigns. And the French or English officers would get angry and say, "But what? Why are you leaving?" And the First Nations guys would be like, "Well, we did everything we came to do. Goodbye." And I wanted to slip that in. So at the height of the siege, when Thorne desperately needs his sort of outwallers to like be a military force, they leave because they've gotten everything they can out of the situation and they no longer trust Thorne. And I wanted to deal with that because one of the things, and I'm not, by the way, saying that Thorne is necessarily evil, but one of the things that I always think when I say read Game of Thrones or various other things, I'm like, why is evil always so united when real world evil always seems so selfish and self-defeating? Like, I'm not saying the wild is evil, but I wanted the wild to never seem united. Like the Wyverns don't necessarily get along with anyone and they don't even get along with each other. And they have their own clan system. And the most unified force, I don't know if this came through clearly, is the bears. I love bears. So the bears like have their own whole thing. And when Thorne turns on the bears, the defection of the bears changes everything for books to come because all of a sudden it doesn't work the way it used to. And so just a tiny spoiler, when Ash rises, he never has the loyalty of the bears. And that makes wilderness warfare very different. And I don't know. I wanted to play all those cards because anything you watch in the modern world, nobody is perfectly unified. Not Democrats, not Republicans, not the Conservative Party of Canada. And I wanted to play all those cards.
Oh, and you played them extremely well. It's funny you mentioned the bears, because I was actually, before our call, I was looking through the first chapter, and right in the first chapter, you get the one about the mother bear and like a circus, and they're trying to get her to like dance and stuff, and like the bear cub, one of her bear cubs gets injured, and she attacks them. And that leads to like a like small factions of like little mini paragraphs throughout the first couple books about the bears and it coalesces in book three, is how you mentioned. But yeah, that definitely came through with the bears. And having you mentioned about Gabriel being a man of the wild, he also has his own magic, and he contains two types of magic. He has the magic of the wild, and he also has the sun magic. And I was actually, if you'll indulge me, I actually pulled a page, a little bit of paragraph from the Red Knight, talking about when he retrieves into his mind to the vault, which I'm hoping we can discuss. So here we go. The captain reached into the palace in his head, a vaulted room 12-sided with high arched stained glass windows, each one bearing a different image set at even intervals between columns of aged marble that supported a groined roof. Under each window was a sign of the zodiac, painted in the brilliant blue of gold leaf, and then a band of beaten bronze as wide as a man's arm. And finally, at eye level, a series of niches between the columns, each holding a statue. 11 statues of white marble and one iron-bound door under the sign of Aries. In the exact center of the room stood a 12th statue, Prudentia, childhood tutor. Despite her solid white marble skin, she smiled warmly as he approached her. So we have a very vivid scene of his inner palace where he stores his magic, and he has his teacher there to kind of show him the way and instruct him on what's going on. How did this come about? Because I was always curious about how this was constructed.
Well, you know, for once I'm going to claim credit and say some of that I just made up. I mean, I made a weird decision. I don't regret it, but a lot of readers have been hesitant about it. A lot of people have said, for example, I loved the book, but, and some people downright hate the fact that I used Christianity at par. I used Neoplatonic Hermeticism, which is like the magical system that people who still practice magic today believe in, at par. And that was done very deliberately. And it's because, I know this isn't the question you asked, but I'll get to your question in a moment. It's because if I say Plato, most readers immediately have a picture. Or I could spend 16 paragraphs explaining a Plato analog in an analogous situation. And I decided I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be able to be referential. Also, I won't give the spoiler, but I had made a decision very early on about who everybody was and why things worked this way that really doesn't become part of the books till book four or five. That being said, where do I begin? There are elements of the way spellcasting works according to modern witchcraft and various forms. I mean, there are a lot of different modern forms of the performance of magic, and I've read a bunch of them. And I'll just say there are elements of that that I thought were not, how can I put this, scientific enough? And I thought, how could I make this work? And then simultaneously, and for completely other reasons, I was reading a book about memory palaces, which really exist. Memory palaces are a thing, and there are very good books on them and their use in the Middle Ages. And I thought, like, ooh, if you were a person of enormous will, you could have a magnificent memory palace. And then I began to think how you could manipulate symbolic magic, like Neoplatonic Hermeticism, in a sentence, as above, so below, or as below, so above. So if I do something symbolic with this small white thing, your white house will burn down because this is white and your house is white, and that makes a connection between the two of them. Right now, someone listening is going, Christian, that's not right at all. But close enough. The problem is that it's all pretty complicated. And I thought, like, wait a minute. If you could basically pre-prep your spells so you could just fire them off because you've done the sort of incantation part in advance, you didn't have to work the magic. You'd pre-worked the magic. And that's, I put that together with the memory palace, and I invented several characters have different ones, but basically it's a mental machine to store prepped magic. That's the best way I can describe it. And so you sort of click through the parts and go like, this is this, this is this, this is this. When I align those three, I have done the equivalent of the incantation to cast the spell, except I've done it in my mind and I've done it in a heartbeat. So in Dungeons and Dragon terms, it means you can cast any spell in a single instant.
That plays more a prevalent role as you go further in the series, but we'll save that for another time. We don't get too much into the spoilers. And one final thing I want to talk about before we get into maybe a little bit more spoiler section of this is your great attention to detail in the battles. Everyone knows you're a fantastic historical fiction writer. You do the YouTube videos with ancient weapons, with swords, and what have you. So this is your bread and butter. How did you want to approach battles in this book? I know you wanted to show the people on the ground level, like gathering crops, gathering all the supplies, and then the building up of the army to the battle. It was very methodical. Was to take a lot of thought. How did that come about?
I wanted it to play out like a real military campaign where every battle happened for a real reason. So first of all, the first three books are escalatory, right? We go from a fairly small band of mercenaries protecting a nunnery from some random monsters to a fight for the world by escalation. And it gets gradually bigger. Hardly the first person in the history of fantasy to do that. But I wanted every fight to, one, illustrate something about my views on fantasy warfare. I guess I sound real preachy. And at the same time, I wanted every one of them to have a purpose. I never wanted to have a fight scene. I think fight scenes should be like sex scenes. Sex scenes are good if they help you build character and they help explain relationship. Sex scenes are merely prurient if it's just two bodies rubbing together, right? Like what was that for? Did we need that scene? Okay, I feel the same way about fight scenes. So yes, it can be military fantasy at times, but I wanted every part of fighting to be directly either part of the story or building character about somebody in some way, whether it's Thorne or Gabriel or Bad Tom or I have a huge cast of characters, which you've been kind enough not to mention so far, but they all have story arcs. And I mean, some of that had to do with fighting. From the very beginning, I wanted casualties to be high, and I knew I was going to kill major characters from the beginning. And so one of the reasons there's such a big cast of characters is I knew I was going to kill so many of them, and I wanted it to matter to the reader. I wanted the reader to go like, wow, this is like, wow, people just die, because that's my impression of medieval warfare. People just die. And then, as I say, I put in a certain amount of at least thought time trying to work out, you know, what's it like to fight a wyvern? And if there really were elves who were immortal, would that give them better morale or worse morale? Like, if you're going to live 5,000 years, do you really care who governs Alba right now? Like, honest to goodness, do you smoke a lot of weed and read some good poetry and go like, oh, you guys are going off to fight Gabriel Murrians. I'm really happy here. Like, wake me up in 1,000 years and maybe I'll be excited to fight a dragon. I wanted to play with that. I wanted to play with some sort of solid memes in fantasy, and I wanted to like reverse them a little. And so the orcs and the elves are one race called Urks, who are both beautiful and horrible and who are sometimes good and sometimes evil. And I just, that seemed more fun to me. But all of the military campaigns, frankly, are absolutely based on real world military campaigns, on real world terrain, so that every part of it made sense. And I hope to the reader, and I appeal to you, Blaze, and you're welcome to tell me if it didn't work for you. Didn't it seem like the fighting was organic? Like this caught all with causality. This caused this because this has happened. This is happening. Now he's going to use wyverns to try and take out the towers to get rid of the long range trebuchet. Now, like, because that's how war often is. War can be full of causality. And I wanted to try and get that across, both at the small level and all the way to the end.
Yes, of course. I actually, Red Knight, I actually read the book at least three times because I just wanted to keep absorbing and catch anything that I might have missed. And the fight at Lizzen Kirik, that actually part of it, like Werens and Thorne attacking with everything, that was very vivid. And it was actually a very slow buildup, but yeah, everything had causation. This led to this, led to this. And then it had the repercussions for that. That's what I felt with every single battle, especially the one in the Fellsword, which is a little bit longer and bigger stakes than the first one. But I always felt that way.
Well, that's great, because really from sort of page, I won't say from page one, from about page 200, I suddenly knew what it was all about. And then I went back and rewrote some parts, and that had a problem of its own, which we'll discuss if you insist. But from then on, I kind of knew where it was all going, and I tried to seed some clues, you know, where it was going. And I like authors who are clever, and I love getting to a point and going, especially on a reread, I love getting to a point and going, oh, he did set up the fireworks in the trench. Look, it's happening right. I missed that the first time through. That's me, but I can name you a dozen authors I love who do this. And I usually don't catch it on my first read, but on a reread, I'm like, oh, that was all foreshadowed. Oh, that's him giving the order to assassinate the guy. That's cool. And I really like that. I don't know why, it's just a thing. So I tried to seed a lot of stuff.
No, you did a great job with that. And several of my favorite authors do that as well. Like Steven Erickson does that. Jenny Wirtz does that. You do it fantastically. So yeah.
You just named two of my absolute favorite authors, Blaze. So that's really good.
I'm very glad. It's like finding a clue. It's finding a $20 bill in your pocket one day that you forgot about. So it's like keeps building and building. So I enjoy that. And this is definitely a series I'm going to be rereading sometime in the near future. And okay, before we get to the spoiler section, I do have one.
Wait a minute. I want to do a piece of shameless self-promotion. Most people don't know, because COVID really rocked the publishing industry, that I think in 2021, we released a 10th anniversary edition of Red Knight. It has 8,000 new words in it. And also, when I say I went back and rewrote a bunch of the first 200 pages, I didn't do a very good job. And some of the mistakes I made weren't caught at the edit phase or the copy edit phase. And because of that, there's a zillion 4-star reviews that say I'd have given this 5 stars, but man, he doesn't even get the names right in the first 200 pages. And that's because I had gone back and done a fairly hasty rewrite, and then I didn't catch my errors. So those are fixed in the 10th anniversary edition, in addition to 8,000 new words, like you get to meet Blanche when she was originally in book one, and then we cut her because it was just too complicated to start the Queen's politics in book one and stuff like that. So all that is back in, and there's a battle scene that isn't in the original book. So I mean, if you've got a reread on anyway, I recommend you reread it the way I meant it to be, which is how the 10th anniversary, it's like the director's cut.
Oh, I'll be sure to do just that. So one final question. This is actually from our author friend, P.L. Stewart, author of the Drowned Kingdom saga. You mentioned earlier that you had plans for a prequel to the series. Are any plans for...
I know your listeners can't see this, but I have Lord and King by P.L. Stewart right here next to me, because it's the next on my read list. He writes great stuff. Anyway, go ahead. Yes, a prequel.
Prequel or sequel to the Traitor Son cycle?
Yeah, so I actually have both in mind. I'm writing 5 books this year. And then after this year, I plan to write like one each, speculative fiction and historical fiction, for the rest of my life, because I have so many books I want to write. And only by punching out a bunch of books this year, and I mean, I love them all, but it was the only way to kind of get some series to where I needed them to be so I could start slowing down. But I'll tell you what I absolutely intend. I absolutely intend a trilogy to... Now, this is a giant spoiler. Can I just say this out loud?
Spoiler for the series?
I'll just say it, and then you can cut it later if you want.
Sure.
All of my fantasy series are connected. They're all in the same multiverse. The Cold Iron series, Against All Gods, The Red Knight, they're all in the same neo-hermetical universe. And they all share gates, and they all could be in contact with each other. And at the end of Against All Gods, at the end of Breaking Hell, which is the third book of Against All Gods, an event will happen which will connect right back to Gabriel Murrian's world. And that will be the very end of that. So it is my intention to write a trilogy that wraps up what I call the Gates War, And it will be mostly centered on the world and events of Traitor Sun and the Red Knight.
Incredible. You blew my mind. Can't wait. Can't wait to catch up in all your other fantasy series so I can binge that. I love authors who are ambitious enough to try something like that and to see where it goes.
It should end up being a 14 book. I'm as bad as Steven Erikson, or I'm not as good as Steven Erikson, but I'm as bad as Steven Erikson. I like the idea of having it all come together. And also there's some team ups I've wanted to do since I started writing it. But anyway, I actually think of the Alba world, the Traitor Sun world all the time. And I've thought of writing short stories, and I may yet, because for my sci-fi, I sort of wrote a book of short stories to hold readers over while you all wait for Deep Black. And I realized that I like writing short stories. Short fiction is a great way of telling some side tales. So I'm not promising, but here's what I foresee. I will probably produce a book or a novella of short fiction that adds up to the forming of the Red Knight's company. And I don't know what I'll call it, but that's what it'll be about, like how they all came together, where Sauce came from, where Tom came from, where Michael came from, how they all came together. Because I know that story. There's bits of it interspersed through the five books, but I know the story. And so I'll probably do that. And then, like I say, I've already talked to Jill Redfern about a wrap-up trilogy to bring all the worlds together and to end the Gates War. And so I'll probably do that. I write fast.
You certainly do. That's why we love you so much. Okay. So with that, I think we will now jump into a little bit of the spoiler conversation for the Traitor Sun cycle. So if you have not read the series, unfortunately, here is where we part. If you finish it, be sure to come back and discuss this. So we're going to go into spoilers, right? In 3, 2, 1. Okay, we're in spoiler territory. I guess the one biggest question I've always had with this series, Gabriel and Amika, they always had like a love-hate relationship all throughout the first three books. And then I thought that they were going to get together. Turns out they don't. Gabriel and Blanche end up getting together and getting married. Well, Amika goes into other things. Was that always planned from the beginning, or is that kind of something that just came as you were writing the third and fourth book? I've always wanted to ask you this.
I always planned it. Okay. And I always planned it for a couple of reasons. One, I'm tired of the guy getting the girl every time. Two, I really believe in religious conviction. It doesn't mean that that's me, but the person I made Amika to be is a woman who has, you know, experienced sexuality. She's been a wife, but she's like made a vow, and she has, after all, this is spoiler time, right?
Yes.
She has sworn an oath to preserve her chastity to save Gabriel's life. And it does again and again, whether you noticed or not. Things happen that are the spell she's cast by making this promise that she doesn't break. And that is his saving grace for three, I think into the middle of book four, like he's still getting away with stuff because weapons bounce off him and whatever. And that is all basically a spell cast by the sexy nun. Also, I believe in vows, and I think Amika is almost the second protagonist. I was so fond of her, and I wanted her story arc to be strong and not about being somebody else's lover, but about being the person that she is. And putting her in the position to say, I won't have your children, but I'll be here to care for them, you know, as a sort of religious figure. Protagonists, they should experience disappointment. Everything should not go their way. And I had a great time playing with the triangle, not the sexual triangle, but the viciousness triangle of Gabriel, his mother, and Amika. And I had a great time playing with that. And that's all to say, like the line from Life of Brian, you know, you may be the Messiah, but to me, you're just a naughty boy. Like, to say, like, here you have this great character who's powerful and he leads men in battle and he does all these things and he still can't get his way. Can't get his way with his mom, can't get his way with his would-be girlfriend. I'm not going to say I thought it was funny. I thought it was realistic, and I thought it was about the bounds of greatness. And also because I wanted Gabriel Moreins to be real life great, I wanted to show how he dealt with that. And I wanted him to deal with that with grace instead of anger or revenge or one of those stupid ass things. Also, I always from the very beginning really loved the character of Blanche. I recognize that some people don't like Blanche, and my feminist friends are pretty divided on Blanche. But again, I wanted to write authentic medieval women. And so a woman who says, like, if you get me pregnant, you are sticking with that forever because I'm a laundress and you're a prince. I couldn't not write that scene. I wanted the laundress to know, you know, and she represents that she's the bastard of a knight. Like, I don't want the life I had, so you're going to take care of a baby if we have a baby. Somebody should say that. Just like one of my favorite scenes in all of the books is when Morgan Mortimer is on deck with all the laundresses on a ship and they're doing laundry. And they basically start saying, like, hey, great magic user, can you do this? Can you make fresh water out of salt water? And then he's like, one of them says, like, could you provide a birth control spell? And he basically, as a 17-year-old boy, is like, why would you want that? And all of the laundresses are like, whoa, wait, you can change the world here, dude. Just, I don't think enough fantasy novels actually touch on, like, the practicalities of, if you had working magic, how profoundly could you change poverty, agriculture, women's lives? Anyway, I had a good time with that.
No, thank you so much for sharing. I always wanted to know that, especially getting into the character of Blanche, because it did seem, at least on my first read, that the relationship kind of came a little bit out of nowhere. But then on rereads, I grew to actually love her as a character. So be sure to keep in touch and keep an eye out for that on the next reread.
Maybe you're going to ask this, and I should just let you, but I do have a story of a character who completely changed, like, who did not do any of the things I wanted her to do. Do you want me to tell that or wait for you to ask?
Well, I mean, go ahead.
Desiderata, the queen.
Yep.
I had some fairly pedestrian plans for her, and she was going to die in childbirth, thus tossing everything into chaos. And it just didn't happen that way. And also, she grew as a person and became, like, stronger and unmalleable and more in charge of herself and more in charge of the world around her. And I'm like, whoa, this was completely unplanned. She was supposed to die in childbirth. That was supposed to be a major scene where Gabriel's mother basically comes and kills her by magic and thus catapults the kingdoms into instant civil war because her baby was going to die. And that made Gabriel Moreins the only contender, and a contender who didn't want to be King of Alba. And that was how that novel was supposed to go. Honest to goodness. And then while I was writing the scene, I was like, well, damn, I think Desiderata is going to live, and that means her baby's going to live, and that's going to change everything. But after I had written all that, my lovely editor, Gillian Redfern, said, I'd have killed you if Desiderata had died in childbirth. She's like, nope, that had to happen that way. And anyway, that was definitely not how I planned it, because I'm a pantser and a planner. If it feels right, I'll go with it. And it just felt right at the time.
Well, that's a good thing you brought it up, because that was not a question I was going to ask. So we learn something new every day. I'm so glad to learn that information. What I was actually going to ask is one of my favorite characters, and he's kind of he's not a minor character, but he starts off is Peter, who throughout his encounters in the first book, he becomes one with, like, the people of the wild, and he changes his name to Nita Kwan. And his just learning of the wilds and adjusting into that lifestyle and the arc that he has throughout the three books is something that I was just completely engrossed with, and I absolutely loved him. How did him come about? And also, we'll talk about his his mentor, who turns out to be none other than Kevin Only, which you leave hints about all around. But that's another question.
So, Peter was always there. And I mean, I think if we had hours, I could tell you about the things that weren't always there. Peter was always there, and Peter is, in a way, a historical figure, an escaped African slave who became a great war leader amongst the Iroquois. That really happened in the real world. And, you know, in my deliberately Eurocentric fantasy, I wanted from the beginning to always have people from the outside, people who wouldn't allow the reader to just sink into a vague sense of, oh, okay, it's Northern Europe and everything is fine. I always knew that there was going to be a major Mameluke character who was going to come in. I don't know, have you read the stories, the short stories?
I have not yet.
Oh, well, we'll get to that then. Peter was sort of the other, because he's Black, and then he goes with the Outwallers and basically sort of goes First Nations. And I wanted that arc to be real. And through Peter, through Ida Kwan, you get to see everything from the other side, while still, I hope, going, but this is a great guy. This isn't a baby eater. This is a heroic, solid individual, you know, going with the course of events, but he's not growing tentacles. He's not eating babies. Wow, the Outwallers all seem pretty decent. You know, like, wow, they don't seem barbaric. They seem like they have rules and they have cool stuff and they have magic. I did want to make darn sure that the reader never decided the Outwallers were orcs. That I wanted to be clear that the Outwallers had their own thing going. Peter, also one of my favorite characters. He almost ran away with me. Like, by book four, there's too much Peter, I've been told by some.
Nonsense. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. You definitely get the feeling that the Outwallers, they're not orcs. They're also, even though they are on the same side in some instances as Thorne, they're constantly in conflict with him until Thorne decides that he needs a captain for his army. And that's when he recruits Kevin Only, he's the last of his name and thought lost. And all of a sudden he's back and how he's leading the forces of the wild. I thought that twist was just fantastic as well. And then finally, what we want to talk about is Ash. Okay. He's the main, the big villain. He's the man behind he's the dragon behind the enemy of Thorne controlling everything. And you find that out at the end of book two, and then all the pieces going in. Introducing Ash that way and finding out what his main desires are, like conqueror of several different types of worlds, and listening, Carrick is one of the portals of the world. What made you want to go like the metaphysical, and what angles did you want to bring to this type of overall arcing story?
Well, Blaze, that is an awesome question, because now I get to say something I've never said in an interview. So here we go. In my first imaginings, everything was going to be told from the point of view of Ash from the beginning of Red Knight. So Ash was always there. Ash was always behind. In fact, the original opening scene that my editor convinced me to drop was Ash and his mother on a mountaintop, the two dragons, Tar, Ash and Tar, basically discussing the world as if human beings were ants. And Ash saying, I'm going to rid us of all of them, and then we'll have peace. I'm just going to kill all the humans, and then everybody can just, by everybody he means the wilds, we can just live in peace. And the best thing of all is I'm going to get them to destroy each other. I'm not going to breathe fire on anyone. I'll just let them do their own stupid things. I'll just help them along. And that was the original prequel. And she said, gives too much away, distracts from what the books are about. And I agree. However, Ash was always there, and Ash was always pulling Thorne's strings. And in fact, one of the short stories that's available online for free, pretty sure, is about Richard Clanger Thorne after the end of the fifth book, because he isn't dead. He's actually sort of sprung from Ash's mind, and he goes into a body. I'm now giving a huge spoiler, but so he ends up, Thorne ends up alive and back in a human body at the end of everything. And he, part of the short story is him basically thinking about like, what the hell, man? I was on a good thing, and then Ash took me over and wrecked it. He hasn't really changed his mind about why he quote unquote betrayed humanity. And I like the character of Richard Clanger. I wished I had had time to do more with him, but Ash is a genuine enemy. Like up until now, I think I've said about the bears and the Urks and whatever, they have their own thing going, but Ash is pretty much just bad, because there's an enormous difference between being annoyed by humans and deciding to kill all of them, that we can see reflected in politics right now. Ash is selfish and bad. And Ash is also incredibly intelligent and yet not very farsighted. And I did that on purpose. Like he does things that are actually somewhat self-defeating, because he's that guy who says, "Do you know who I am?" He's full of his self-importance. And one of the themes that I try to keep going through all five books is that evil is its own worst enemy. And that if you do certain things, that's who you are.
Yep. That theme certainly carries throughout the whole five books, and not just with Ash, with all the characters, there's always something more to be learned. There's always an angle that they're looking at the world, maybe that you haven't seen before. So it always has me questioning what's the ulterior motive, and what is the best outcome for both sides, and how to avoid catastrophe. It's a series that always made me think, and I thank you so much for writing it. And I can't wait to just dive right back into it. It's getting my blood rolling all over again. So, and yeah, this has been a fantastic deep dive. So I thank you so much for it. Before we log off, could you tell the audience members where they can find you, social media, your fabulous YouTube channel, where you get historical reenactments and stuff like that?
Sure. So I'm one Phokion on Twitter, or am I Phokion one? You know, I get this wrong, and I should know this going on in. Pardon me. This is a 61-year-old looking up his own Twitter handle. I'm Phokion one. Look, I'm Phokion one on Twitter. I'm no fan of Elon Musk, but I happen to like Twitter. Good fantasy people often gather on Twitter, and that's kind of fun. And if you restrict your Twitter feed to only people like you, Blaze, your Twitter feed is full of nothing but good fantasy novels, which is how I try and keep it. So Phokion one, I'm available on Instagram as something, I think, Christian Cameron Author. And I'm also Christian Cameron Author on YouTube. I do a series on all three of those social media channels called Writing Fighting, hashtag Writing Fighting. And a lot of it is ancient and medieval martial arts, but it is all from the point of view of helping writers write better fight scenes and understanding how weapons really work. I teach various forms of fighting and fighting in armor and stuff like that, and I'm pretty good at it. Not as good as some people I could name, but good enough to help writers write a better fight scene. And I want to specify that, because people, I mean, very good people often go like, "Oh, that's not how I do that technique." And you know what? There's better martial artists than me in the world, but very few of them also write fantasy novels, although I can name a couple like Ed McDonald. I'm really just trying to help. So I'm just saying, like, when you write a fight scene, if a guy falls down with a shield, he's going to have a really hard time getting up again. It's one of my pet peeves, by the way. And I do not have a copy yet, but my next book is called Storming Heaven. It is out, I believe, July 22nd. My launch, if you live anywhere near Toronto, my launch is at Back of Phoenix in Toronto, which is on Harvard and Spadina. And we'll have a nice party. It's book two of the Age of Bronze. And Age of Bronze, first book is called Against All Gods. People seem to have liked it. And I've now completely spoiled that all of these books exist in the same multiverse. So, team-ups will come. The world serpent will turn out to be a dragon who probably knows Ash. Oops, did I say that out loud? And eventually the worm will eat its tail and turn out to be the worm of Eros, and everything will come together in a beautiful plot synopsis. Actually, that's not probably true. It'll probably be chaotic and difficult, but I look forward to it.
And we're all looking forward to reading those as well. You just completely blew my mind with this interview, and I can't thank you enough from the bottom of my heart. Christian, thank you so much for joining me, and I hope we get to do this again sometime.
Blaze, I really enjoyed this, and I am at your service whenever you want to have me on. I'd love to talk about other series.
Yep, as soon as we get to them, we will have you back on. So thank you so much again, and cheers, everybody.